the changes in the document. I'll kind of run through them fairly quickly as a reminder. Several actions have taken place since you approved the budget in June. There were actions in the budget that was adopted by General Assembly very late in the year that amounted to about $43 million. State revenues have also been adjusted. There were some interim update was done in August that produced about $160 million or so in actual reductions to the HMO and the maintenance fund and due to the trust fund. There was a positive increase of about $83 million in the priority transportation fund. And that positive to the PTF makes the felt reduction smaller than it is, because it's important to note that the PTF monies are basically dedicated for debt service purposes at this time. There was an action made to withhold the accelerated sales tax collection to the TTF, an $18 million impact. And we had been anticipating a potential loss as a part of HB 5010, but that diversion of the sales tax increase that was originally anticipated was diverted again, undiverted, I think is the right word, on Monday, so that is no longer an impact to the program. And we did include in this update the increase of federal funds related to about $65 million in bonus OA that we received from Tucker Highway. So just jumping in pretty quickly, in grand total, the program, the six-year financial plan, only changed by $28 million, which is very small in terms of a $32 billion program, but the impacts, though, hit in different places, so that we felt important that we update the program accordingly. This schedule just shows you kind of the impacts across the revenue sources and across the years. Note that the greatest impact is in the HMO revenues, down about $140 million, and offset by increases in the PTF and federal. Just to elaborate a bit on the reductions in the state revenue sources, this kind of highlights the main sources that were updated and the impacts. You can see that the biggest increases are shown at the very top, motor vehicle sales and use and license fees. And it's also important to note that recordation taxes took a pretty substantial reduction. And the recordation taxes are a line item that have a greater impact on transit than they do on highways. This schedule shows the impact from a programmatic spending perspective. And you can see the increase in debt service, really, that is the additional PTF monies being held in a reserve for debt service. And you see the increase to maintenance is largely related to the bonus OA that we received. And then you see the reduction in rail and transit, and that number is large, $85 million, but a lot of it is prospective. And I say that in that there were amounts changed in the program, about $45 million in the program, that were shown previously in the DRPT section that were now shown in the highway section. So it's just where the money resides because of the flavor, the color of the money. So it's only from a revenue perspective, only about a $40 million impact. And a lot of that is related to the recordation taxes that I mentioned earlier, the impact of transit.
So Mr. Lawson, since you're comfortable that the bonus money and how it flows through between DDOT and DRPT is appropriate?
I'm sorry.
In other words, if you look at the slides, of course, we haven't got the DRPT, but you're comfortable that the reductions that are coming from transit are appropriate based on the way the money's flowed.
Absolutely.
Mr. Dyke sent an email.
Correct.
Wanted to make sure that we were not treating transit any differently. I think a lot of it had to do with the bonus monies and how they flowed through. You were telling us that that has been done correctly.
Yes, I mean, the bonus OA dollars, you know, were distributed to a small portion to highways. Maintenance got the bulk of it to go toward paving. The biggest reductions you're seeing is what I call the real reductions, because again, that was depending on the kind of money. Some of the monies that are used on transit or rail related projects will show in the DRPT section, and others will show in the VDOT section, even though it's going toward the same project. A big piece of this was there were some high priority CTB formula money in the outer years going to the light rail project that we're showing in the DRPT budget. We have since, because of the revenue reductions and unable to provide the CTB funding in the out years, we replaced it with some previous bond dollars that had been budgeted on the VDOT side. So they're now shown in the VDOT side of the program.
Okay.
So while it looks like a loss, the loss is not to the project. The project is still there, and the money's on it. But previous dollars allocated on the highway side.
With the increase in funding for the maintenance and office department, can you provide us, you may not have this now, but I would be interested to see the breakdown in the allocation in the applied service area, whether it's going to interstate, primary, secondary.
At this point, the increase has not been programmed to any particular area. We brought the money in, and let me back up. I'll say that the bonus OA dollars were used originally to kind of backfill what we thought was going to be the $50 million loss associated with the reversion of the sales tax increase. So those dollars were put on paving work that actually had already been completed in order to free up state dollars. And the building collected those funds. The monies that were made available by that action, and then the return of the bonus OA, the sales tax reversion money, has basically been parked in the maintenance program, because what we wanted to do is make sure we get past the next update of revenues, which will come with the governor's budget next month, and as well as the snow season, before we go committing those dollars to any particular area.
Mr. Chairman. So on this OA money, I want to be very clear, because in noting Mr. Dyke and understanding, so the bonus money, from a net perspective, DRPT is not taking this proportion loss relative to VDOT gaining $16 billion in OA money. What's the net loss? Is all this money really going to VDOT? Is it? I mean, I understand
all of the bonus funds went to VDOT.
And why didn't DRPT even have any cuts? I think that's what Jim was really getting at. Why did they have any of their cuts backstop or back?
Yeah, that's a decision that honestly, not to point to you, Mr. Commissioner, but that was a decision that was made internally.
It's historically, and this is something that I've talked with Ms. Mitchell about, historically, at least, I'll say historically for last 4 years, the bonus has been coming back to, we've gone after a bonus and brought it back into the highway side. We need to look at some portion of, I don't know what the right term is, maybe prorated portion that could come back to the transit side. Part of what happens with bonus is it coming in very specific areas of federal funding. Some might be transit, available for transit, some may not. It's not just I'll call it a clean pile of federal money that you can do anything you want with it. It has to go into specific areas. So it probably isn't a precise percentage. It really depends on where we can bring money back in and where potentially transit can accept money back into and obligate it. That's the other part of this. You have less than 30 days to go from the offer to obligation. So this is one of the things we've talked about, and we're going to take a close look at at making sure that it's balanced.
And I bring that up not because y'all are the professionals. $68 million to VDOT is a lot of money, but it's relative to the entire budget. You know, even 10% of that to DRPT, just round number, $7 million is a huge number to DRPT relative to their overall budget. And I just wondered why we were focused solely on the highway.
What we heard was, we're not going to do that. That's not going to be the administration's number two, I think what they said is, looking, they combined that with the other reductions we had to take, or taking that into account and allocating the money. So, in a way, it has been accounted for, but I agree with you, Mr. Rosen. In the future, we're going to spell it out. I mean, and I think, so there's not a default, an automatic default that goes to VDOT in that regard. So, I think John's answer was right. I mean, in terms of, you look at the whole cuts, and they tried to smooth it out the best they could, but we'll make sure that's, so I agree 100%. Because we've had that conversation.
And I can just,
in as much as there is a short window where money is received and allocated, and in as much as this is a recurring issue, shouldn't we then consider a policy that can be relied upon in the future, then we'll have to go through that every year?
I think because of the color of the money, we need to just be disclosed what it is and where it can go. Disclose to this board how they've done it. If you want to make a change, I don't think we should make a rigid policy. I think we should say, where can the money go, and give this board the opportunity to say, how do you want it allocated? I think that's the.
As long as there's time to do that.
Yeah, that's right. And with the recommendations, you've got to be able to obligate it the whole bit. I think instead of saying we want X to do this, we just disclose to this board, you got these monies in, here are the various areas it can go to. Here's where we recommend it, and so it's very upfront. The board knows where the money's going. It gets really back to, and meant to be a personal criticism, but this is the Commonwealth Transportation Board makes the decision to allocation. I do not want the agencies making a default allocation until we know what they're doing. That's really what the policy is going forward. And I don't think it was intentionally. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, but we need to be aware, particularly in this environment, as to where our monies are going.
John? Mr. Raymond, just a point of clarification, again, just around the kind of money itself.
Yeah.
And bonus obligation authority, I want to make sure everybody understands what it is you know, we get an apportionment, you know, by category from federal highway every year. And then there's a limitation called bonus obligation authority on how much of your apportionment you can actually obligate during the course of the year. What bonus OA is an increase in the amount of the apportionment that's already been provided that can be obligated. So it's not like the obligations across the board, meaning the apportionment have an increase. It is that now they say, instead of being able to obligate 90% of your apportionments, now you can obligate another, in this case, $65 million. And it's because some other state wasn't able to obligate all their funds.
John, could you just give me in big numbers what we're talking about, our authority and our apportionment, so they understand the kind of the scale of what numbers we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, error in my 90% was actually pretty close. We err, full apportionment is about $1 billion a year. And then our constrained obligation authority is just over, or right around $900 million. So it's pretty close to 90%.
Secretary?
Yes, sir.
But I take from what you said, though, that the responsibility ultimately rests with the CTB on where those bonus dollars go. Is that a correct statement, that that's what you'd like to see for the future?
Yes, I want to see, that we just, that this board has the opportunity to see how we allocate money. Again, I don't think there was any intention. It was just the way things have been done.
I just
want to make sure as we know where the money's going.
And John, the bulk of this was converting existing projects, if I recall.
That's correct.
So this is another technique that we use to quickly obligate money. And the same can be true of transit, where you have existing projects and you basically, you put, it's, they're federally eligible, and we convert the money on those projects as federally eligible money, and we can do it literally immediately. So it's not a new project that we add. Now, in some years, we have, through bonus, we've been able to add typically paving projects are the things we've done, but in this case, it was conversion of existing projects.
And they were paving projects.
And they were paving projects, but that's how we did it. That we were able to convert the funding type on projects. Yes.
I'm right away in defense of the allocation as previously looked at. You know, the percentage of this money that's coming to us because rail or transit projects were not allocated across the country, I suspect, is relatively small. If we're going to look at it in terms of that. In terms of impact immediately to the Commonwealth Transportation Fund and able to get projects moving across the board, most of those are going to be through road projects, paving, things like that, that we can immediately get done this year across the Commonwealth, because we have to remember the vast majority of this transit money is being spent in one transportation district, whereas this money that's coming in here is going to be spread across the Commonwealth.
I'm just saying that what we ought to do is make a conscious decision. That's my point. I mean,
I agree with that
100%. But that's sort of a default. We ought to say, you take the recommendations, they work together, and say this is what we think, and then we vote as to whether or not that's what we think. Okay.
Just two slides, just talking about the budget themselves, which again, this is just the first year of the 6-year numbers you saw earlier. In terms of fiscal 15 for the TTF, with all the pluses and the minuses, there's only a $500,000 change in the nearly $5 billion budget. And that this slide shows the distribution of those dollars. Again, about 40% of the total budget goes to maintenance and includes payments to localities, and about 21% to construction. Turning to the VDOT side of the budget, its budget increased by about $7 million. Again, we mentioned bonus OA earlier, $8 million went toward construction. The other $58 went to the highway maintenance program. Again, a lot of that was intended to address what we thought was going to be a $50 million loss related to the sales tax diversion. We did, and as I think Laura mentioned to you in September, we took a hard look in administrative areas, trying to make some reductions to minimize the impact on the core programs, and crossover as was also adjusted as a part of this process, because we had to shift some additional construction funds, swap some federal and state money with maintenance in order to keep maintenance whole and address all the state funded needs on the construction side. I think you've seen this graph before by Laura, but this is where, and when you look at the blue line, that's where crossover was expected to be in the 13 through 18 program. The red line is where we were with 2013. We were expecting by 2017 crossover would be gone away. With the December 13 update, which was the basis for program that you adopted in June, you can see crossover returns, and then with today's adjustments, crossover rises just slightly in the outer years. So, and you can see the trend at the tail end is rising. So the picture doesn't look good in terms of the crossover going away.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes, Mr. President.
If you look at the green dot in 2015 and the purple dot in 2015, the reason that number has gone down is because at the end of the day, like most things that we do as Americans in Virginia Tech, we've done everything, we can't do it wrong, and finally get it right. That's because the money was put back in yesterday or Tuesday.
The green line reduction, the drop in the green line is because we had to shift, we had to put more federal money into maintenance and take pull back some state money in construction to meet some of the state funded needs.
But the revenue pie got $50 million
yesterday. It did.
We actually never had taken it out of the projection. So we didn't really do it. But
that doesn't account for that.
Doesn't count. There's a good look. You all read what went on with the budget action. There were two parts. One was this $50 million, and then in terms of whether or not it may or may not trigger the kill switch, and House Bill 2313, as you know, if there were any monies diverted, that was automatically to mean the entire package. So that was dealt with. And then, of course, there was a movement primarily in the House, I guess some in the Senate too, to delay the increase as of January 1st of the motor fuel sales wholesale tax that will go from 3.5% to 5.1%. We now know, Speaker Boehner has said that bill will not come to a vote, will not even get out of this committee. So that will go in. That was not, while it was some histrionics, it did not pass. So I think the leadership and the governor understand that these revenues should flow and are committed that they flow as is that. Now, what that doesn't shield us from is continuing economic activity and what that may or may not do to future projections. But I think from a legislative side, I think the House leadership, Senate leadership, and the governor's office have made it clear that they are not going to do anything other than let the transportation dollars flow to where they go. That's a good point.
I asked a question on that because if you look at slide 6, we're projecting out motor vehicle sales and use. We're not. We're projecting some of those revenue sources out through to fiscal 2020, but not all of them. How can we? I'm just curious why we don't project them all.
The slide you see here is showing differences in the. The updated interim forecast.
So you're assuming that we're going to get it right in 17, 18, right?
Correct. The updated forecast did show a change in the number here.
But let's make sure who's assuming. He has to take forecasts provided to him.
Exactly.
And so, in other words, I know we had comments. Well, why can't? We have this conversation inside that, you know. What makes us think they're going to continue on this path? Unfortunately, by law, and we have to program by law what the forecasts that are given, just like we do on the budget, on the general fund side.
Sorry.
I agree with you.
Okay. Caught back up here. Lastly, this slide just shows the total revenues to VDOT and the net change of about $7 million when you look at it by revenue source. And this shows the change in terms of program. Mr. Secretary, that's my last question.
Mr. Lawson, you want to, just quickly before you get down, let's not have a question, but just mention about the bond ratings and why you're up there, our trip.
Okay.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
This is just following up on some of the comments, but once that $65 million is programmed, would it be possible for the CCD to know how the money is allocated?
Sure.
So that will come back and it'll be a proposal to us. Because I didn't know with the 30-day window if there was a deadline for getting that done.
Secretary Valentine, as I mentioned, we have utilized the dollars. We've already identified the projects, put it on the projects, billed the federal government, and collected the dollars. So we have used the federal bonus money. What we have not done is utilize a like amount of state money that was replaced, that was offset. So we're holding that money kind of, like I say, in a reserve till one, we'll be getting another revenue forecast as part of the governor's budget in December, and we'll be, obviously we don't know what the snow season will bring. So once we get past those 2 points, then we'll be able to decide how we want to use those dollars, and clearly we can come back to the board.
So you understand, we took federal dollars and freed up state dollars. That's because they've already spent. In fact, there was a conscious decision the commissioner made, which was the right one, keep spending when we thought the trust fund may be insolvent. We won from that. It was the right decision because we were able to get a bonus. If we had pulled back, we may not have been able to. So, correctly, VDOT did a great job in doing that.
And John, we actually applied for 215 million.
It was over 200. I don't remember the exact number.
So we, in terms of what we did, is we went after the opportunity comes to us every year late August, and we actually requested over $200 million from the federal government. Frankly, not expecting to get $200 million, but if you don't ask, you don't get that opportunity. So we went after a much larger pool because we had that many projects that we could convert from state funds to federal funds. And again, out of that came this amount. In past years, we would sometimes immediately go, because paving contracts are going out this time of year, we would immediately reapply that state money on paving contracts. But in looking at our overall financial structure and with some uncertainty going on, the thought was we just needed to hold that in reserve, especially as we were heading into winter. We had our fingers crossed on winter, but again, we thought it was prudent to make sure that we were okay before we were put out any additional work.
Okay,
just quickly an update on the bonds.
Scheduled to go to price a next sale of CPR bonds on the 19th. So we'll be issuing $300 million. Well, we'll be sizing the issue to net $300 million in proceeds. Secretary, Commissioner, and I went to New York and met with the rating agencies 2 weeks ago, I guess. And we received AA+, AA1 ratings from the three agencies, which is just one notch off of the Commonwealth. AAA. So we were very pleased to maintain TL rating, maintained. The rating agencies continue to speak very highly of what they call good quality Virginia paper. And we're doing all we can do, obviously, to maintain the quality of our debt and continue to work with you to make sure we use our debt prudently.
Mr. Fralin, the topic you brought up was clearly a topic of discussion with the rating agencies, and they were pleased to know that it was, like it was headed this way. It was also the day we flew over the space flight coming back, so we'll all remember the exact day we got that agency rating. So.
And I even have a picture of it from the plane.
The pre-disassembly.
Yeah, pre-disassembly, yeah. Okay.
We move on into the next.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
In conjunction with the update of the budget, there's been a revision to the fixture improvement program. There were kind of two reasons for updating the program. One was to address the revenue impacts that I was just talking about, but almost more importantly was to help prepare for implementation to HB2. There were a number of projects where it was determined that the projects were to go through the prioritization process and funds were removed from the non-exempt project as part of this update. Just by way of update, as a reminder, the current program does utilize the CTB construction formula, what we call the optional formula that was put in place by 2313 community bills. Which means there's no money going through the traditional 40-30-30 formula. We held 9 public hearings across the state as part of the fall transportation meetings. Had 429 people actually attend the meeting, and a combination of 504 comments, either written or in person. HB2, we continue to work through this process. It's important to note that HB2 does not change the allocation formula. Funds still go through, are distributed by current statutory means, as I mentioned, using the optional CTB formula. And there are the state and federal funds that are not excluded by HB2, will be allocated draft of code, because as it exists at the time of programming. There were a number of project types and categories of funds that are excluded from the prioritization process, and you see them listed here. Repair related, some of the regional funds, some certain categories of federal funds, and any funds that may be distributed through the secondary and urban components of the original 40-30-30 formula. In this update, there were 64 projects that were impacted in terms of funding. Funds were removed and are being held as a reserve to be used for funding projects once they are scored. So this group of 64 plus other candidate projects will go through the prioritization process, and ultimately, based on the directions of you, will be programmed in upcoming six-year programs. In comparing the revised program to the final, it's almost a little confusing when you see that the total program actually went up by $100 million. And then we explain that increase while they're cutting and while this actually showed an increase. The final FYIP was 9.9. You see where there was a reduction of almost $200 million related to formula funds. But then as we worked through the program, there were some actual adjustments that took place. And again, this is the highway component of the program. We have a number of projects that we have partners with local governments, and on some of those projects, we have about a $50 million increase in local contributions. I mentioned earlier some adjustments related to the transit programs. Because of those to's and fro's, there was actually an increase of about $40 million on the VDOT side of the program. We talked about maintenance program. The maintenance program, as shown in the SYIP, increased by about $140 million. And just to clarify, the Fixture Improvement Program shows the federal money that is going toward the maintenance program. Not the whole maintenance program, just the federalized component. So we had to, as you saw in the crossover slide earlier, we had to swap out some state money with federal money on the maintenance side to help balance on the construction side. And then the addition of the bonus OA is why you see the increase here. And then there's a slight increase of federal to construction. Again, you saw the $8 million we had from bonus OA, as well as some title grant funds. This shows just the details. You can see where there were some reductions on interstate primary and increases in the maintenance and then the other categories at the bottom. I think, Steve, this is your cue.
Thank you, John, members of the board, Chairman. I guess I just want to take a few minutes of your time to update you on the presentation I gave back in September. First, we talked a lot about the revenues declining, and we did have an additional reduction due to the accelerated sales tax from what we had earlier, about $4 million more. So now we're up to $17.6 million that we're dealing with in this draft six-year program for 2015. There's one point that's not on the slide that I just want to put out there, and I was just thinking about this morning, because this slide and the next two slides, part of the point I'm trying to make is, you know, where we've gone from when HB 2313 passed about 16, 18 months ago to where we are today. And the net impact of HB 2313 to rail and transit was about $115 million a year, which was great. But as you see on this next slide, you know, we've lost $31.7 million from that time, as well as an actual loss of revenues being short last year, 14, But in addition to that 31, I want to focus on for a minute, is the loss of the Marketplace Fairness Act that never came to fruition. And that net loss to transit was about another $20 million in addition to this 31. So out of that $115 million number, about $52 million is gone. And then we're looking at another reduction, it sounds like maybe in December. So almost 50%. Of what we thought just really 18 months ago to where we are today.
So I'll comment on that. It's 50% transit, about 30%, I think, is what it is on the highway side from the original projections. So we're about 30% below where we thought we'd be on 2313 from just July 2013 and on the highway side, and 50% below what our projected revenues would have been out of that on the transit side. That's the magnitude of the projected loss of revenues. Now, whether that's because their earlier projections were too rosy, or whether or not the economic activity and price of fuel and all that, all a part of it, but that's really where we are in that.
Yeah, the way I like to think about it is, whatever, 18 months ago, it's where the General Assembly and the governor at that time, that was the level of revenue they thought was sufficient to cover the needs. And I don't think, at least on the transit rail side, the needs haven't really gone away. So anyways, I don't want to belabor it. We've talked a lot about it, so I'm going to go through these slides real quick. Today, y'all are going to take action on a six-year program that we did have to put $17.6 million more reductions into that program. This is the actual detail of the different DRPT programs that it impacted, which looks very similar to what we had before, except before it was around $14 million back in September when I was up here. And essentially, we're going to handle those reductions through either reductions to our reserve for transit and rail, I mean for mass transit reserve, or to our budget, we're going to have a reduction, or we're going to use unobligated balances. And then just as I spoke on the last meeting, there's a provision for y'all to take action if there's a statewide need to move mass transit trust fund capital funds to mass transit trust fund operating funds. And that's how we're going to fill that gap for the operating loss, is that second bullet on this slide. And the reason being is we're in the middle of the year, a lot of transit operations, especially the smaller rural and small urban, they get a lot of that funding up front. And so their budgets are set, they're halfway, 5 months through the year now. We don't want to be cutting their service now. So we've been giving them guidance for next year that they should be expecting a lower amount. But we do ask y'all to make that special provision today in the action item. And as far as the detailed items, this is the same list you saw in September, except the fifth bullet down. We did add, we did allocate in the planned allocations in the future years $31 million to the Ark and Delta Powell's Creek project. And what that's for is for platform work that, you know, we're looking at the planning of how the platforms work in order to utilize. You know, in the design, we end up with three tracks. We want to be able to have platforms that all three tracks can be utilized to access those passenger platforms. And some of the designs, it forces only two of the tracks to be utilized, which obviously can cause bottlenecks. And the whole point of having three tracks is to not have bottlenecks. And finally, I just want to touch on our budget, because y'all are going to approve a revised budget for us. And the only change in the budget, which is our budget, is really just our estimate of expenditures. And because of the operating shift and using the obligated balances, we really didn't have much of a programmatic change to our budget outside of that admin budget reduction of $600,000. With that, I'll gladly take any questions.
Just one comment I would like to make. Ms. Mitchell has been working on, we have some very high profile projects that are going to take a lot of time. The wraps for the Potomac higher speed rail tier 2
which we're gearing up. It's going to take a tremendous amount of staff time. We have an aggressive schedule to get that done in 3 years. The bus rapid transit we'll be helping Richmond as that's put in. The potential for the light rail both in Virginia Beach and Arlington. So the staff is going to go to some fairly extensive use of manpower to get these projects done. Ms. Mitchell's been working on a program for that, but with these not program cuts, but with the limited dollars we have for administration, we're working with VDOT to help in terms of being able to make sure they're staffed appropriately. I just wanted the board to know that, because these are very, very intensive projects that require a great deal of staff time to get them done. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, next I think we have Mr. Donahue, and I think you have a few changes, but Nick will let you take us through your next portion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this morning, as I look for the right presentation here, we have several presentations. Again, this is a part of the long-range plan development process. At the last meeting, the board heard some discussion about demographic trends and some other trends. Today, the consultant team is here to talk with you all a little bit about some economic trends, as well as travel and climate trends. If time permits, after they're able to get through that, we also have done a survey where I have to say about 3,000 Virginians responded, and they have some initial findings for that they're going to walk through. But just a refresher before the consultants get up here, what we're doing here is going through all of these trends and providing them to you all as the policy board, so that when we come back in January and start to talk about goals and objectives and other things for the long-range transportation plan, you have kind of a general understanding of the broad trends we see facing our transportation program moving forward between now and 2040. The other thing I do want to say about this is, again, these are trends and they're projections. We do not know whether or not, you know, this is exactly the way the future is going to play out, but this is some of the better analysis that we've seen, and I think if you see trends that you like, we should, you know, figure out what's causing them and make sure that our policies reflect that and can strengthen that moving forward. And if you see projections that you don't like, I think it's incumbent that we then figure out why that's there and look at ways we can take investments to reduce the likelihood of a trend we don't want to see take place. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn it over to the consulting team, and I'll be over here to answer any questions the board may have as we move forward.
Yeah, that last comment that Mr. Trump, you mentioned, is very important, because the trends are based on the last few years' history, and as you well know, the Commonwealth has not seen a very good history since 2008. We're still 114,000 jobs behind where we were in 2008. So again, that we're hopeful that we can shift these trends. So please don't take them to say that this is the way it's going to be. You see something up there. We're hoping our actions, the governor will speak on this today as he works to improve the economy. Hoping the actions we take will make these trends different than they appear. So.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Laura Parkins with Michael Baker, and I'm just going to take a quick moment to introduce our speakers this morning. So we're back, the V-Trans team is back for the second installment of discussing trends with you and sharing some information about the future. Our economist is going to give you the rest of the disclaimers this morning, as we were just discussing. It's just really important to keep in mind that forecasts are predictions. They are just that. So this morning we're going to cover the remaining topics that we haven't touched on yet. Last month we talked to you about the demographic trends and the technological trends. So today we're going to focus on the economics, and that includes both workforce needs and goods movement. Then we're going to talk about the environment, and keeping in mind that what we're talking about is a little bit unusual in that we're talking about how the environment affects transportation. Normally, we have a lot of discussions about how how transportation affects the environment, but our discussion today is kind of the other way around. Then we're going to finish up with some insights on trends in travel behavior, and then, as Nick says, time permits, I'll come back at the end to talk a little bit about the survey we just conducted. So I just wanted to tell you who our speakers are this morning. We've got Andreas Eppling with Cambridge Systematics for the economics portion, and then for the environment, Krista Gooden with CDM Smith will be back to speak with you. And finally, for travel behavior, we've got Don Berry, also with CDM Smith. So with that, I'll turn it over to Andreas.
Good morning. Thank you, Lorna. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, board members. So, elaborating a little bit on the discussion about forecasts, it's important to understand how they are constructed. And they're basically derived from top-level economic trends that are going on in the U.S. and all over the world. So they bring together primary drivers are population trends, demographic trends, and what's happening with age groups, what's happening with monetary supply, monetary strategy between the, not just in the U.S. but across the world, global trade, and a number of other sort of big macro-level factors. And these trickle down to the regional and state level based on the kinds of activities that occur in the states. And they generally do a great job of predicting what happened in the past, less so what happens, what's happening in the future. It's essentially, these are typically projections that are based on past behaviors and what we can expect. So they're very poor at determining or projecting, for example, inflection points. If there are new industries that are developing rapidly, those generally are not picked up or picked up very poorly. If you see changes in large industries, there are industries that are currently large, those industries start to slow down in their growth. That typically is not picked up well at all in these kinds of forecasts as well. So these are basically sort of, these forecasts present what basically conventional wisdom as we know it today into the future. So this next set of slides here I'm going to present show a number of different snapshots of the Virginia economy now and projected through 2040. So these are sort of the top level measures, things like economic output, things like income, things like employment by industry. And I think by now you've probably already seen quite a few maps that look like this. What's interesting to highlight out of these things is that they are there are some subtle differences when you look across these different measures as to what's happening geographically within the Commonwealth. So the first one we're going to look at here is the overall economic output by county. Not surprisingly, you have the urban concentrations having the highest output. Absolute output happening by, they currently do and they're projected to continue to have that general pattern through 2040. Keep in mind, of course, that output is a very important indicator of future transportation demand, both directly in terms of workforce mobility as well as freight needs. So here we're looking at the change. So the blue maps show the absolute numbers, the maps of the reddish color show the change between 2012 and 2040. Here again, these trends are probably not a surprise to anybody, show very strong growth in Northern Virginia and some of the other urban cores around Richmond and the southeastern part of the state, as well as some parts of the central and western part of the state as well. But particularly if you're looking at overall percentage of growth, actually the remainder of Virginia looks very, is quite strong. In terms of absolute growth, you will continue to see, or the expectation is that you'll continue to see the concentration in the northern part of the state region. Employment follows a generally similar pattern. So this is again forecast total net employment by 2040. Again, you're going to see very high employment in the northern part of the state, as well as around Richmond and the southeastern part. But you're also seeing some pretty solid growth in other parts of the state as well, the southern area along North Carolina, as well as even the southwestern part. Change in employment. Again, in terms of, in this case, in terms of both absolute numbers as well as percentage growth, you're seeing, again, very solid growth in the northern part of the state, and basically the urban areas. And the rest of the state is expected to be fairly flat. However, there are very few counties where there's an expectation of a decline that's plainly very modest. Income is a little bit of a different perspective. So this is essentially payroll, how much people are getting paid, plus other direct benefits. And in this case, we're showing forecasted income by 2040. Again, the patterns are pretty similar, but there also are some counties pop up that are among the more less heavily populated, and it's very much a reflection of the demographics that live there. And here's the forecasted change. Again, consistent pattern you see here. But you know, there's some parts of the, you know, it's distributed. There's some distribution across the state, which again is, I think, is overall a good positive sign that there's not just total concentration in two areas. Now shifting over to, so we've looked at sort of general trends geographically. We're now going to shift over to look at what's happening to the individual economic sectors and how are they, the individual growth by these sectors will very much influence where this growth will occur in the state, as well as the types of employees that are required to sustain it, the kinds of income those folks will generate. So we'll drill into the top sectors here in a minute, but there are really four, in terms of gross output, there are four sectors that really dominate everything else and are expected to continue to dominate in the future. The first one is real estate, which I'll have to talk about a little bit more in a minute. Public administration, so that's federal and state government. Manufacturing, which is expected to grow very rapidly, and professional and scientific. And then after that, surprisingly enough, healthcare is not one of the ones in the top four. It's quite a bit smaller than the other sectors, followed by information systems, retail trade, and so on. If we look at this from an employment perspective, the picture changes a little bit. So public administration moves in the first place. Healthcare moves in the second place. So this is an indication that these are fairly labor-intensive sectors with lower average income and output than the sectors that have been real estate and manufacturing. It's also a more gradual scale here. So you have, rather than having four that really stand out very strongly, you have a bunch of additional industries. You've got about the top six or seven have very similar or close to similar output, and thus are very critical from an employment standpoint. Notably also, before you had manufacturing as a top four sector, but if you look at it from an employment standpoint, it's about in 10th place. Now this is looking at incomes, and essentially it's wages and benefits, direct wages and benefits. And here we have some standout sectors. Again, a bit of a shift around professional scientific. It's expected, is currently in second place and is expected to grow very, very rapidly in first place. Public administration, interestingly enough, is also expected to grow very substantially, and then followed by healthcare, administrative support services, construction. So looking at some of these top four sectors and drilling down into what makes them up is provide some revealing information as to really their impact on transportation demand. So, for example, real estate, which is projected to be the largest sector by 2040, it's one of the largest now, is primarily made up of transactions. So when you sell a property, that gets recorded as output, and essentially it's not labor intensive. It's certainly not transportation intensive. It's essentially a financial transaction. So it shows up very large on the scale, but in terms of overall impact, again, we were looking at transportation demand, it's very minimal. Rental and leasing services looks like a really small bar, but it's still in 2040, it's still a $10 billion plus industry, so it's still a sizable part of the economy, and that has much more of a direct impact because that's essentially people are purchasing a service there. It's associated with, you know, some maintenance activities and management activities that do generate payroll. Professional services. So when we're talking about the future reflecting the past, I really think this is where we have to review this with a major caveat. The forecast projects, you know, more than a doubling, almost a tripling of computer systems design related services. If you go back and look what's happened the last 10 years, it's definitely the case. If you want to look ahead 25 years and make the claim that this trend will exactly remain, I think you can really ask some good questions about whether that makes sense. But that's what the forecast shows. The other ones are all more like management, scientific, and type of consulting services. You know, it's still about a 50% increase, and the other ones really are showing modest increases and even a few declines. For example, legal services actually drop off. Architectural engineering related services are barely expected to change. Manufacturing is composed of quite a few subsectors, and a couple things are worth pointing out here. First of all, food manufacturing is actually the largest manufacturing sector in Virginia at present. Reflects things like processing of chickens, of livestock. Manufacturing of frozen packaged foods are a significant part of the manufacturing economy here in the state. Transportation equipment is actually composed of really two subsectors, military, shipbuilding, and then also there's some vehicle component manufacturing going on in the state. That's also a significant sector. Notably, chemical manufacturing is making a very rapid shift from basic chemicals, which are relatively modest in value, to pharmaceuticals, which is the reason why you're seeing such a huge explosion in output projected through 2040. The transportation demand associated with that is probably going to represent quite a shift. Right now, it's probably primarily bulk. By 2040, a lot of that will be heavily reliant on certainly truck, as it currently is, as well as probably more aviation. If you're shipping pharmaceuticals around, those often go by air, so that'll have particular demands. I would expect a particular sort of shift in modal mix for that sector. And fourth largest is public administration. At present, you know, we have the federal government, its operations in Virginia are very substantial and are expected to remain so, seeing some 25% growth by 2040. State and local government is also expected to grow at a smaller rate.
I have a question here. If you look at the top 10 employers in the Commonwealth, I think 8 of them are either city government or universities or state and all that. And yet that's where we've lost a substantial amount of our jobs, if you look across. So I guess even in this environment where we have sequester and all this demand, you're still suggesting that potentially these are going to grow.
Yeah, and I think they're really, and I think oftentimes these are heavily population driven, so the general population is expected to continue to grow, then you're going to see these sectors continue to grow. I mean, it's a fair question, and Vic asked me, you know, whether this incorporated some of those shenanigans that have happened, like with sequester. And the answer is the macroeconomists sort of take a long-term view and generally don't, unless there's a permanent downward trend, they will not incorporate sort of short-term shocks to the system. But it's entirely possible.
Mr. Williams, the projections for like chemical manufacturing, is that national trends or is that Virginia trends you see specific?
That's Virginia trends specific. Yeah, these are all Virginia trends. Questions? But of course, they are derived from national trends. So they look at, you know, the general trends, the composition of the industries in the states.
Well, I was wondering, just like the chemical manufacturing there, why we experience such explosive growth that we have inbound companies that do that in Virginia, or project that.
Right. I've wondered the same thing, and it's been explained to me that's really being driven by pharmaceutical growth, which is you can generate a lot of output in with actually rather small facilities. You know, single pharmaceutical plant can account for, you know, $500 million or $1 billion in output, and goes out by air. You know, shipments might be happening only a couple times a week. I mean, it's really it's of that nature. So another way to look at this is sort of is to see how the development, which we saw in the previous maps as well, to see how the development is being concentrated by sector, by region, and then the work that we're doing currently, we're examining these kinds of issues in more detail. But you know, when you look at, you know, some of the industries or sectors are very much population driven, like, you know, retail, trade, employment, pretty much, you have higher employment areas with higher population, lower employment areas with less population. Same thing with healthcare and social assistance. You know, this is payroll in this case, again, pretty much tracks population. Other sectors are really concentrated in a few areas, like, you know, finance and insurance. And professional services is a little bit more dispersed, but generally the same trends. So just taking a while, going back and looking at that, you know, that chart showing massive growth in information systems employment projected through 2040. This is a historical look back for professional services employment shifts from 2001 to 2013. And you can see how much that that's expected, it has what it represents now and what it's expected to do in 2040. Unfortunately, the colors are not all that visible, but the again, you know, the biggest expected growth is in the Washington, D.C. area. Computer systems design related services is expected to increase by 18,000 employees. That's a lot. Management technical services by 11,000. Whether this is really going to continue or not, I think it's still a very much open question, but it's certainly out there. Another way to look at what's happening, or really looking at the importance of the transportation system vis-a-vis economic development, is something called industrial specialization or location quotient analysis, which is essentially comparing industrial activity for a particular sector in a region like a county in Virginia with the national average. So if you have a very high concentration of a particular industry in a region versus the national average, it would have a high location quotient. So for example, you can look at the trends in concentration over a period of time. For example, architectural services, which increased substantially in the Lynchburg area, to a pretty high level density, 3.04. 1.0 would be average across the nation. 3.04 would be, you know, roughly three times the typical density. When you look at that, though, you don't just want to look at the level of concentration. You also want to look at the impact that an industry makes. So what we've developed here in these two slides is just an example of what we're doing, is to show how these industries are developing. Are they growing? Is the sector getting more, is a region becoming more specialized? Are these industries that are not so specialized but important to the region? So for example, taking a look at manufacturing, in Virginia, we have a couple of really standout regions of the state that really dominate the manufacturing sector. We've got Newport News, that's shipbuilding primarily. Isle of Wight is also near the Newport area, and Alta is heavily manufacturing and has very high concentration. These are all showing growth. Warren County, which is where Front Royal is located, is expected to grow substantially. Now, it's a smaller manufacturing base than Newport News and Isle of Wight have, but it's expected to grow very rapidly. And I think part of that has to do with the availability of intermodal service there through the Front Royal terminal, good connectivity on the highway network, and some very aggressive industrial development efforts in the region. Rockingham and Harrisonburg, which are also in the north and north central, northwestern part of the state, on the other hand, have very sizable manufacturing, again indicated by the size of the dot circle, but they're less concentrated, and they are also not expected to grow as strongly as the sectors on the right. An example of an industry that is not cleanly represented in the typical, when you saw the industrial breakdown, the way economists look at activity is tourism. Tourism is comprised of a bunch of different sectors. And you know, by itself, it's not a top 10 sector in the economy, but it is substantial. So you know, in 2012, for example, you had tourism, which is essentially kind of comprised of hospitality, for hire transportation, tourist attraction, employment, and the like. It generated $21.2 billion, which is definitely a pretty significant output. It's also very labor intensive, so that generates, in turn, will generate a fair amount of traffic demand just by itself, and makes some significant contributions to payroll as well. Another example of an industry that is very transportation dependent but has a relatively modest impact on the economy of Virginia, direct impact on Virginia's economy, is agriculture. It is, you know, Virginia is not a, other than tobacco, it's not really top ranked state in terms of production in any sector, but nevertheless it is significant, particularly in terms of poultry production. It does come in 14th. In terms of, you know, cattle is 23rd, but still more than half a $1 billion industry. And these all have substantial and significant demands on the transportation system. In this case, most ag is moved by truck, but there's also significant rail component that comes into play as well. Employment trends in Virginia for ag have generally been on a downward trajectory, similar to the drop in land that's devoted to agricultural uses. But in the last several years, there has been a bit of an upward increase in employment, and it has to do with, at least to some degree, with a shift in production to higher value crops that are more labor intensive. Net effect of agriculture and other sort of more rural activities is that the overall employment is expected to change minimally between 2014 and 2040. But however, within that net effect, it's not expected to change much. You do have some significant shifts within, primarily away from agricultural employment towards healthcare and social assistance, and that's a reflection of the projected demographics. Older people living in rural areas who need higher levels of medical assistance. It's also a reflection of some in-migration in those regions, people moving to rural areas who are either retired or are on the verge of retirement that will require healthcare and social assistance. So moving, the next several slides are about what are the implications for goods movement. This is still very much in a preliminary state, but I think it's worth looking at some of the sort of the macro trends that impact what's going on, what's expected to go on with goods movement, how that will impact the Commonwealth. So first of all, this chart shows expectations overall nationally in terms of transportation, freight transportation demand and how that compares with Virginia. It's notable that pretty much every sector is expected to grow through 2040. That's not much of a surprise. What is a little bit of a surprise are the differences in projected growth among some of the modes. So one that stands out is water, where water is expected to decline substantially in Virginia and see modest increases in across the U.S. That is domestic water, that is not international. So this would be coastwise shipping, generally of bulk products, as well as barge shipping of the rivers. These are from very small volumes, so there's not a whole lot of domestic shipping by water going on in Virginia. So for example, the Port of Richmond is redeveloped to handle more domestic trade. That could completely shift that that trend. And that's very important to understand. Certain investments and policy decisions can really influence the growth of these individual modes as well as the mode shares. Likewise, you see a very a much more dramatic increase in rail service and rail demand in Virginia versus the rest of the U.S. I think that's very much a reflection of sort of the location of the Commonwealth along the eastern seaboard and some general very favorable trends in rail traffic in the region through, you know, initiatives like the Heartland Corridor, like the Crescent Corridor, like the National Gateway Project that CSX is underway, and that definitely can drive, you know, that can drive load shifts, it can drive demand for transportation as well. Another thing that I think is very important when you're looking at general freight trends is what's happening with, you know, where, you know, how do you access the system? And one of the key developments really in the last 30 or 40 years has been the development of intermodal facilities. Many times when people think of intermodal, they think of just truck and rail access, which is certainly important. It's been growing very rapidly, but it's also access to airports handling, they're able to handle cargoes in high volumes. And of course, ocean ports. And so the Commonwealth itself, you know, you've got Washington Dulles being a major international airport, has a tremendous opportunity for growth in air cargo. You have the ports down in Newport News and Norfolk handling international container ship traffic as well as bulk goods. And then it's also important to recognize when you're looking at intermodal access, you don't only need to look at what's going on within your state, but also what's going on around it. And actually, Virginia is relatively underserved by in terms of intermodal terminals within the state, but there are a lot of terminals right nearby, and those are certainly when you're looking at how do you accommodate freight growth, you not only want to focus on what's going on within the state, but also what's going on around it. One of the things that's happened in the last several years is you're all aware of the general decline in transportation demand on the highway side, you know, the real flattening of the growth curve, particularly with personal vehicles, there's actually been a little bit of decline. On the trucking side, that decline has also happened to some degree, but it's actually there continues to be some growth in demand. So when you're looking out ahead through 2040, there's a general expectation that the kinds of activity that will be supporting that will be driven by industrial development, manufacturing, as well as population growth and income growth, will continue to drive a growth in demand for freight transportation. And with so much of our economy dependent on trucking, that will become apparent as growth in demand for truck services and increase in traffic related to goods moving on the highways, in addition, of course, to the other systems as well, like rail. But that, again, you can, there are policy and funding levers that can kind of drive how that develops and where that happens. If you want to see more of that traffic on rail, then there's certain kind of policy choices you can make to support that. If you want to see that, that happen on the highway, there are other policy choices that you can make to support that kind of development. So that wraps up my discussion.
I just wanted to know what was behind the number for real estate being such a strong economic sector for us. And you're projecting it to be number one. I was just curious how you arrived at that.
It's all transaction based, So if you have if you sell a property that generates activity in the economy and that gets added to the total.
So you just see a far more transactions than taking
place.
Right.
I think what they're really expecting is a continued growth in real estate property values in the denser areas of the state, which will really drive up prices.
For instance, apartment communities had little recession, even this, because of the policy of Fannie and Freddie Mac continued to support. They were one of the few things you could borrow against. And so that industry has continued to generate, as they sell, revitalized in there. So it's not really adding a whole lot more jobs, but
and
it is
nothing.
It's
actually,
nothing, yeah, but it's enriching those entities that in which you then pay taxes for those transactions.
Oh, I just found it interesting.
Yeah, it's really, in terms of impact on the rest of the economy and transportation system, in many respects, it's very modest.
Yeah.
Could you go back one slide here?
Sure.
I don't know how many slides there. Now, that's long-haul truck density there on 81 in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, bring the math here, 4 years ago. Was there any effort to project that out to 2040?
We're doing that. That's where we've just gotten the entry in that. So we will have information.
Looks to me like that's going to be clogged.
It's clogged already.
It's clogged now.
Yeah.
So in terms of planning, it looks there seems to be a little bit of differential in. You look at the 81 traffic coming down, going southbound 77. There, I'd be interested in seeing how much that 81 traffic southbound on 77 across a foggy mountain. That's a safety hazard, and I'm curious to see what another route might do.
Yeah, we'll be looking at that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
Thanks for the presentation. I'm kind of curious right now, what are your data sources for this? You have to ask me right now. Because a lot of the, I know you're talking about projections and the macro look, but a lot of the information we're getting today is professional service jobs are up, or retail jobs are up. Everybody's sort of in a crisis mode, so you seem to indicate that we solve that problem going forward. How do we do that?
In the macroeconomists think you have under this is one of the.
Do they have any indication of how we do that?
Not at this point. And that's sort of one. We're looking at a range of forecasts. So those forecasts you saw today were primarily based on the Moody's long range forecasts. We're also looking at some others and what happened. There are some big macro forecasts, Moody's and IHS, and track each other fairly closely, but there are others that are more regional based that are more specific.
And there's good news for the rest of Virginia, roadway.
Yeah.
Pockets of growth and income increases.
Massive income increases.
I would like to see that.
Yeah. Okay. we can definitely do that.
All right, we'll go to the next presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Krista Gooden, and I'm with CDM Smith.
As Lorna previously mentioned, our team researched trends that may impact transportation in the future. For environmental trends, we focus on climate change because of its potential impact on transportation infrastructure. For this research, we summarized potential climate changes in Virginia that were identified during the Governor Kane's Climate Change Commission in 2008. We also researched newly released data by federal agencies. Virginia's coastline is the second most vulnerable region in the U.S. to sea level rise after the Gulf Coast region. The low elevation, degraded ecosystems along the Chesapeake Bay, and rates of sea level rise is making this region more vulnerable to climate-related impacts. In 2008, the U.S. DOT conducted a study to give their policymakers a high-level estimate of sea level rise and storm surge impacts on the national transportation network. This study looked at 9 scenarios of global sea level rise between 6 centimeters to 48 centimeters by year 2100. This table is showing the impacts from the 21 centimeter scenario in Virginia. While the study did not define specific changes in water levels at specific points in time, the 21 centimeter rise could occur between year 2040 and 2060, according to the International Panel on Climate Change. In Virginia, a 21 centimeter sea level rise, which is about 8 inches, could mean about 1.8 miles of interstate highways inundated and 9.9 miles at risk. Inundated means permanently underwater, and at risk means temporary flooding due to storm surge. Railroads may see 4.7 miles of inundation and 35.7 miles at risk, and the total impacted land area could exceed 250,000 acres.
So again, you're saying an 8-inch rise in sea level?
Global, yes.
Global.
Okay.
Would potentially impact almost 2 miles of interstate. In a normal condition or a storm surge condition?
That would be in a normal condition.
Okay. I'm just not aware of any interstate in Virginia that's 8 inches above sea level. Even high tide, I don't know any stretch of interstate in Virginia that's anywhere close to that. That's what I'm curious about.
Probably through Willoughby Spit.
Yeah, except that it's all elevated. I'm just curious about the where these come from.
Well, this study took the actual sea level rise data from the International Panel on Climate Change, their research, and then it layered that information with digital elevation models that they got from each state. So they're using
Is there a higher expectation, 8-inch globally, but is the potential rise in Hampton Roads significantly greater than 8 inches?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. This figure is from the same report, giving you a visual of the inundated and at-risk areas in Virginia from a 21 centimeter sea level rise. The Hampton Roads area is especially vulnerable as it possesses the second largest concentration of military capacity and activities in the U.S. and is home to the world's largest naval base, the Naval Station in Norfolk.
What's the timing of this?
2040?
This study did not look at specific levels of water change at specific points in time because it will vary depending on conditions. However, it took a 9 scenarios of sea level rise, about 25 years in increments, and so the 21 centimeter could occur between 2040 and 2060, okay, according to the research that has been done.
Thank you. So 25 to 35 years.
In 2008, the Transportation Research Board released a study identifying potential impacts of climate change on transportation infrastructure. Rising sea levels coupled with storm surge may lead to more frequent flooding of tunnels, marine terminals, warehouse entrances, and low-lying infrastructure along the coast.
Sure.
Sure.
Well, Charlie, question. Look at it. It's hard to see because it's small.
Yes.
But I think it would be valuable to have this blown up.
So you know
where you've got, where those 2 miles are, and what I assume this core correlates to your earlier slide about the 2 miles of interstate that might be
Yes, sir.
Because that seems to be something we're looking at. So maybe you could give us a better slide.
Okay.
Okay, one of the things, and we'll get back to the other slide, is that, like, for instance, downtown Midtown Tunnel, we're having to build seawall on the existing, Midtown. And, of course, the new tunnel, you'll see it when we go down there in a few months, is raised up because it routinely floods now. My guess is it's going to be Norfolk area interstate around them because they routinely flood down on a major rainstorm. I mean, it's so. And again, the key thing is, and I'm no expert by any, I've just seen these presentations, but the 8 inches globally, because we're at some of the most high risk, it's significantly more than 8 inches in Hampton Roads because of, you know, it doesn't, it's not everything raises, water runs to the lowest, you know, all that sort. So we get impacted higher, and that's a, or Hampton Roads gets impacted higher.
Another impact of climate change is an increase of very hot days and heat waves. This could lead to thermal expansion of bridges and pavements, as well as rail track deformations. In Virginia, the I-95 rail corridor is subject to buckling during periods of hot weather. During these events, railroads may impose a heat order to reduce speeds to prevent derailments. Between year 2005 and 2007, while CSX was undertaking major maintenance on the corridor, numerous heat orders were issued, causing several delays to the Virginia Railway Express commuter services. While the heat orders have decreased since maintenance has been completed, future increase in hot weather events could impact passenger and freight rail performance. Intense precipitation events may also increase, which could lead to flooding of roadways, rail lines, and airports. Flooding events can also cause scouring of pipeline supports and bridge foundations. More frequent strong hurricanes can lead to infrastructure failures and damages to ports and harbors. In July, Governor McAuliffe convened the Climate Change and Resiliency Update Commission, and Secretary Lane serves on that commission. The commission is charged with updating and prioritizing the recommendations from the 2008 report, as well as identifying sources of funding for implementation. To summarize these climate change trends, preparing for these projected long-term impacts on transportation from climate change may require changes in how transportation professionals plan, design, operate, and maintain the infrastructure in Virginia. Most transportation infrastructure being built now is expected to last 50 years or longer. Therefore, it's important to understand how future climate conditions might affect these investments in the future.
Go back to that slide. I understand. What about the quote unquote good events? Reduction in snow removal, reduction in, if all this comes to be, it seems to me there are some offsetting pieces. We would have our snow removal budget might be less. The damage to the roads from salt and infiltration into the steel infrastructure might be. Are we looking at that side too?
We haven't, but we certainly could. We were focused on what impacts that we need to prepare or add up the transportation network. So we can definitely.
No, and you're right. They're looking at long-term climate. There are weather impacts. In fact, the short-term impact, we're having extremely cold winters and going to have, looks like another one this year. So, yeah, you're right in there. So from a long-term climate change, obviously, you would expect, for instance, if the northern states have a longer growing season. I mean, there's some different things going on. So, but I guess theirs was just morally on the current impact to our roadways from this. Whether there's some benefit, that's a good point. Maybe there are.
Any other questions?
Thanks for the presentation. This talks about the impact of climate change on our infrastructure. How do we translate that to decisions we make that may impact climate change?
One of the things that the USDOT is doing right now in FHWA, they're doing pilot studies with some states on adaptation planning for climate change. So they're doing that right now, figuring out how DOTs can prepare their investment future on what they need to do to prepare their infrastructure. Some of it is as that, like a road, let's say, that's on the coast, as that is, comes up for rehabilitation, it may need to be elevated. But also making sure that if you know that there is a bridge tunnel and understanding what needs to happen to that in the future, whether that means
there we, obviously we have to make decisions that impact the carbon footprint. Are we going to be talking about that later on? The things, the decisions we make that can address some of these issues.
Okay.
Mr. Connors, that those are the types of discussions that when we come back in January, I think it would be appropriate things for the board discussing the goals and objectives portion of this thing. We wanted to make sure that you all got the trends first before we started to talk about what the goals and objectives might be. I think this really underpins our policy and really understanding what we think there. So there will be an opportunity for the board to have those types of discussions. I think the goals and objectives discussion in January will be that venue. The other thing is we are also going to connect these various trends. Right now we've laid them all out, just kind of here's this and here's this. You're going to see more synthesis of these trends that will come forward in January and February that might help get some of the things Mr. Fralin's mentioned as well as some things to your reference.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you. I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Don Berry.
Hi everybody, I'm Don Berry with CDM Smith, and I'm going to be talking about two aspects of travel behavior trends. One is commuting, and the other is the overall demand for highway travel and how that's changed in the recent past. So the most reliable source at a national level of regional travel survey data is the American Community Survey. That's been available for decades, and good trend information has been built up over time on that. But it collects information on one trip purpose and one trip purpose only, and that's the commute trip. It's the trip that that we use to gain our everyday livelihoods. And while it only accounts for about 16% of all daily trips, those trips are concentrated in the journey to work sense in the peak hours of congestion. So we very definitely pay attention to them. And for those of us who commute to work every day, we often make other trips as well, chain trips, if you will, for errands or for shopping. So we're going to be looking at some trends in commuting in the Commonwealth over the past 10 years or so. And we'll start with commute trips. So as you well know, most commuters in the Commonwealth drive to work, and most drive alone. Right now, about 77% of all commuters drive alone to work. This map shows the percentage of commuters that drive alone to work, and it shows that in most counties and cities, the commute mode share is either between 70 to 80% or even higher, from 80 to 90%. There are some notable exceptions that don't show up particularly well on this map, but they are the area around Charlottesville, that's Nelson County, Arlington, Alexandria, Norfolk, and Williamsburg. All those areas have SOV, single-occupant vehicle mode shares of under 60%. This next map is a bit of a misnomer. What we're talking about here really is carpooling, those who carpool or share ride show up in the red colors with lower mode shares for carpooling in the light brown and tan colors. Can you see a trend here? Well, if we overlay the interstate system, you'll see that the counties, especially Prince William County and counties around Hampton Roads, where there's an extensive HOV system, have higher carpool mode shares. Otherwise, there's really no discernible trends, and it relates to socioeconomic factors such as the number of vehicles in the household and the household composition. So we pulled out in this table some of the cities and counties that have some of the lowest shares of single-occupant vehicle travel in the Commonwealth. And we note that some of these cities and counties are notable for their high mode shares in other modes. So, for example, Nelson County, which is where Charlottesville is, has a high carpool mode share of about 17.8%. In Lexington City, where you have a VMI and Washington Lee College, that has a very high walk-bike mode share, almost 29%. Norfolk City has a high mode share of work-at-home. That's about 7.8%. And as you probably well know, Arlington County has a high public transportation mode share of about 28%. We've also taken a look at some of the commuting trends over time, and what this graph shows here is the changes in commuting trends between 2005 and 2012 across the entire Commonwealth. This chart does not show single-occupant vehicle travel, but that has stayed relatively constant, and depending on whether you begin your trend at 2000 or 2005, it's either grown very slightly by a tenth of a percent or declined very slightly by a tenth of a percent. The chart shows that carpooling has, in fact, decreased overall in the Commonwealth, even though there's been a bit of an uptick since 2011. And correspondingly, the public transportation, walk, bike, motorcycle, and working from home shares, those have all gained in importance and share throughout the county. But there's a tremendous amount of variability behind these numbers on a county-to-county and a city-to-city basis. Looking at public transportation, overall in the state, the share of commuters who take either bus or rail, subway, for their commute stands at 4.2% now, and that's up from 3.4% in the year 2000. Most counties and cities really have a very low public transportation mode share. The big exceptions, of course, being Northern Virginia, who are well, the counties and municipalities there are well into the double digits. This chart shows the commute share of work at home. That's another growing trend in the year 2000. About 3.2% of workers reported they work from home today, or in the recent past, that number grew to 4.2%. The high work-at-home share areas tend to be those that are relatively remote, and they probably are areas, and we can corroborate this, that have good broadband access. Walking and biking has remained relatively constant since the year 2000. It grew to 2.7% from 2.5% in the year 2000, and we've got areas such as Arlington, Williamsburg, Lexington City, Charlottesville, and Arlington that have relatively high walk-bike mode shares. In those areas that have negotiable city streets and have a sizable percentage of work at a university, the walk-bike mode share tends to be relatively high. And so when we talk about transportation investments, as we will in V-Trans 2040, we talk about economic development and we talk about quality of life. And health outcomes are certainly one trend that we keep in mind when we're talking about both of these outcomes, health and economic outcomes. There's been some work done looking at the mode shares for transit and walk bike and the correlation of those shares internationally with obesity rates. And not surprisingly, where you have higher availability of public transportation and walk-bike, you tend to have lower rates of obesity. And so several countries are shown here. But this work has also carried over to the United States. And there is some research that has looked at individual communities in the U.S. With similar cooperative findings. So a couple of facts. 30% of transit users get 30 plus minutes of physical activity every day by taking a train or a bus. And then public transit users walk an average of 19 minutes daily getting to and from their transit stops. So that's cheaper than a health club membership, and it does give people some physical activity. That's a good thing. All right, we did some very simple statistical analysis to corroborate what we would consider a common sense notions, looking at the relationship between population density and mode share. Walk and bike is correlated with higher population densities and a significant correlation, and again, this happens in Northern Virginia, occurs between population density and using bus rail. Conversely, the less dense the population, the more likely commuters are to drive alone, to drive with others, or to work at home. And the relationship we saw was slight but noticeable. Okay, and then we've been looking at several of the counties that generate the most economic output in terms of payroll, and looking at them and what their mode shares and tendencies tend to be. And you see that in the lower half of this slide. And what this bottom line is for me personally is that every county and city that's generating a sizable amount of economic activity is in a different place in the transportation sense. And we have to start V-Trans by understanding that fact. So, for example, Henrico County, 83% SOV. Prince William County, 15% carpool. Arlington, 25.2% public transportation mode shares. And these are the starting points from which we're going to be developing our recommendations for V-Trans 2040. You can look at these mode shares as a straight average, but when you begin to weight them in terms of economic output, you get a slightly different picture. So if you look at the dark blue bars on the slide, you'll see that statewide, 4.4% currently of workers take public transportation. But when you weight that by economic output as measured by payroll, that number jumps to an equivalent 7.5%. So that gives a little bit of an economic spin and context on some of these mode share numbers. Correspondingly, for workers working from home, the number shifts from 4.7% of all workers working from home to 5.5% when weighed by payroll. Okay, so we've been talking about the commute trip. These last two slides are looking at highway travel and the trends there. You may have been briefed or seen these types of slides somewhat previously. It is showing VMT trends in the Commonwealth from 2002 and 2012. And these trends track national trends very, very closely. So to go off the chart just a little bit, between the years 1990 and 2000, we saw consistently high growth rates in VMT that tracked very closely with economic output. And then sometime in the mid-2000s, we began to see a steady drop-off in vehicle miles traveled. And again, this is not just for commute trips, this is for all trips, and it includes trucks. And that's still true in the year 2013 as we begin to emerge from the recession. Whether you look at vehicle miles traveled in an absolute sense, or in the sense of VMT per capita, we're seeing a gradual drop in demand for highway travel. So this is something to be aware of, try to understand the reasons for, and to move forward with V-Trans 2040. And then lastly, and for a very long time, economic output as measured by gross domestic product has tracked very closely with highway demand. You can see this chart that came from Marty Wax, University of from RAND Corporation, actually, shows trends in VMT and upward growth trend in both U.S. GDP and U.S. VMT all the way from 1956 to sometime in the year 2000, where they begin to, as the term goes, decouple. And so this is really, I think, one of the critical slides and starting points for V-Trans 2040 to achieve sustained economic development and to maintain mobility without necessarily increasing the burden on the highway system. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Nick to see if he has any additional comments he'd like to make.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I have nothing more to add, but I just want to say again, I think the team is doing a lot of good work here. This is just the beginning. If there's other things that you think consulting team should take a look at, please let me know. We'll do our best to bring that additional analysis into future updates to the board. You are going to have this on your agenda probably each month for the next few months once we come back in January, because a lot of heavy lifting is going to have to start in 2015. Remember, these trends feed into the vision plan, which is phase one of the plan. What we're going to start early in next year is the needs assessment. And that needs assessment, again, is going to be very important because that is going to be strongly linked to the prioritization process, where when the local government sends us a candidate project, it will only move forward to be scored if that project meets a need that's identified in that needs assessment. So we're going to start talking in January about how that needs assessment is going to move forward, because we're going to need to undertake some of that work simultaneously with updating the goals and objectives. But again, that heavy lifting is really going to start in earnest in the next calendar year. And Mr. Chairman, we do have one more presentation on surveys, if time's permitted.
I think we've got an hour and 10 minutes, so we've got a little bit of time. So yes, let's proceed.
Okay, and so now you're going to hear on the initial findings of the survey that was conducted earlier this year for about 2 months. And again, I do think we had a really good turnout, but I'm going to let the experts speak to it.
Thank you, and good morning again. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of the findings from a survey that we conducted over the last several months. You may recall being informed over the summer that that the VTrans team was conducting an online survey, and we succeeded in receiving almost 3,000 responses to the survey. I have to say up front that it is not a random sample. It wasn't a kind of a statistically organized survey such that our results are perfectly representative. So the participation was voluntary. So I'm going to spend the first few minutes describing the responses that we got and the characteristics of those respondents so that we can kind of put that in context. But we were very pleased with basically outreach that included a lot of email contact and basic forms of publicity. We were able to generate quite a good response. We fell just short of 3,000. We had 2,932 responses to the survey. And the map that you see here, the colors are a thematic map of the Planning District Commission by population. And then the dots are the survey responses that we received. So you would expect to see more dots in the darker regions on the map, and in fact, that is what you see. We had about four regions where the number of respondents was particularly low, such that we'll be careful about reporting results at that level, and those have a star on them. They include the Eastern Shore, the Northern Neck, and some of the South Side districts. But overall, we were very pleased to see that we had responses from all over the state, and we do generally correlate a higher number of responses in the more populated. Looking at the demographics of our respondents, again, some characteristics sort of track with the state overall, and some are a little bit different. We did pretty well on average age. We didn't have any children respond to the survey, so if you just look at the average age of adults, teens and adults in Virginia, the average age is 45, our average age was 47, so we were really close on that one. However, in terms of race and income, we definitely had more white respondents than the average for the state. We had a little bit higher income for the respondents, although the highest range of our respondents is the same range as the Virginia median household income. And then in terms of employment status, we have a little bit higher ratio of full-time employed respondents. The statewide average for that is about 60%, whereas we had about 80%, which means that we might not, and you'll see this later, we might not have had as many retired people. We certainly didn't have any children who don't work full time. And then it looks like we also fell a little bit short on students. So overall, we had a lot of working adults respond to our survey. And throughout the development of our report, we're going to focus on generation quite a bit. And even in the conference that you're attending here, you'll hear a lot of focus on that topic as well. I know Friday is dedicated to a lot of information about millennials in particular. So we want to make sure that we're looking at our results from that perspective. And again, just kind of benchmarking our respondents to the to those generations. Excuse me. Our share of millennials is actually pretty much right on track or a little bit low for what we see in the state, whereas Generation X and Baby Boomers are a bit high in our survey responses. throughout Virginia, the share of millennials is about 21 to 25%. Generation X is about the same, so we have a little bit higher share there. And then the baby boomers represent up to about 30% of our residents. So we have a really strong showing in this survey from the baby boomers, but then not nearly as many of what we call the silent generation, which is age 69 and older. So the first question that we asked our respondents was to tell us how they primarily commute to work. What is their main form of commuting? And you just heard Don walk through a number of statistics on this. What we found in our survey was we had about 62% who drive alone, primarily drive alone. So that's quite a bit lower than the statewide average of 77%. We also had 15% who use transit in the form of either bus or rail, and 14% that walk or bike, and those are each about 10% above the average for the state. That representation in the survey of work at home is right about on track with what you would see in the Commonwealth. So it's important to know that that's our audience in terms of the responses that we're looking at. The next question that we asked was, how would people like to commute? And what are the obstacles to commute the way that they would like to? And what we found here was an even greater desire to commute by bicycle or by walking, some of these alternative modes. And then 31% said that they like driving alone, they'd like to keep doing that, or they would like to do that if perhaps they don't now. I think the reasons why are very interesting. In many cases, people aren't taking these alternative modes because they're not available, they're not accessible, or time limitations. And the time limitations, I think, are an important thing to keep in mind, particularly when we see some of the geographic patterns. So this table kind of cross-references the answers to that question, how you would like to commute, and how you commute today. Just so you can see that that overall, it appears that there are fewer people who would prefer to drive alone than actually follow that form of commuting today. And there's a greater desire for bicycling, walking, and rail transportation. So I think an important takeaway here is that when we looked at the trends a moment ago in commuting by different modes, you saw increases in these alternative modes that we see here. And this would indicate that demand will continue. There is even more latent demand for those alternative modes than those that we see using them today. The next series of questions that we asked in the survey was about how long it takes people to commute and how satisfied they are with their commute. I don't think it's surprising to see in this table that there's basically a correlation between the people who have short commutes, they seem to have a very high degree of satisfaction, and the people who have longer commutes have a lower degree of satisfaction. Over in the right-hand column, you also see that nobody was dissatisfied with their commute when they worked at home. So that's another comment. And then this map shows kind of the geographic distribution of those responses. And again, not surprisingly, thinking about where people have longer commutes, you see those counties having a higher degree of dissatisfaction with their commutes. And then also, you also see some rural areas. And again, the commutes tend to also be longer in some rural areas. So that's a correlation we tend to think immediately of urban areas, but rural areas have some of those issues as well. And then this is kind of the inverse then, in terms of being very satisfied with their commutes, you see most of the state falls into this category. So throughout the Commonwealth, there are really a large number of people who are pretty satisfied with their commutes. Next, we have to
hear from everyone that isn't.
The silent majority theory, right?
That's right.
So the next question we asked, this was actually at the request of one of our multimodal advisory committee members. They asked us to include a question about how congestion affects people's choices for leisure travel. So earlier in the economic presentation, you saw some of the statistics on the tourism economy and how important that sector is to certain parts of the Commonwealth in particular. What we found in our survey is that about half of the respondents said that they do change their decisions about leisure travel on the basis of traffic congestion. And the strategies that they use to avoid congestion include taking an alternate route, avoiding peak travel times, or selecting another destination or simply not going. So that does kind of cement that link between some of our traffic congestion issues and the concern that exist for our tourism economy. And then looking at those responses geographically, we see that the people, particularly in the most urbanized areas, have the greatest concerns about congestion affecting their leisure travel. But there are spots, the newer valley pops out as well, for example, as having some concerns with that. The next question that we asked, and we asked a whole series of questions, I'm just going to touch on one in particular, asking people about what are their transportation concerns and what are their issues. And we're going to come back with a more complete report of some of this information after we have a chance to kind of stratify it by looking at those different age groups and those different geographies to see if there are some trends within the state that we can talk about. But just in terms of all of the respondents, looking at the question of what our primary focus areas should be for the transportation investments, 27% was the highest number of responses for one answer, and that was for maintaining existing infrastructure. So that was the number one answer. Number two is investing in local public transportation. Number three was investing in bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. And number four is investing in new roads. So all of those topics rated highly, but certainly the greatest concern stood out as maintaining existing infrastructure. And just kind of drilling into some of those more generational-oriented conclusions, we found, when we looked at the question about how people would like to commute, we found that millennials in particular and Generation Xers would particularly like to bike to work if they had a choice, and there was a strong showing among the baby boomers for that one as well. In terms of the reasons why they don't make those choices, time and availability of infrastructure was particularly strong for the millennials, and then the availability of the infrastructure was a strong response for Generation Xers and boomers in terms of why they can't bike to work. In contrast, we found that the oldest age group really did want to drive alone to work or to school. Both the oldest and the youngest, actually. We had a really small sample on the youngest, so I don't know if we can infer too much from that, but that just may be about high school students who are eager to drive themselves to school. Looking at the question about transportation challenges, the greatest concern for all generations, the number one was traffic congestion. And then as we look at the question about what we should focus on in our transportation investments, there were a couple differences here. Generation Xers and boomers, so the older age cohorts, if you will, were more focused on maintenance of existing infrastructure, whereas millennials had stronger responses in the category of investing in local transportation, public transportation. So that was the key difference we saw when we looked at that response across the generation. So those are just some initial findings. We're continuing to kind of slice and dice the data. If you have any questions you would particularly like us to look at in how we report the findings, I'd be happy to take note of that. But that's just a kind of first look.
Great. I would assume from the sampling that the response we got back, this, while interesting, this is not much of a tool to develop much of your planning from. Based on this, the sampling error has to be huge.
Well, it is a large sample, which helps. So we're just being careful that as we look at different responses, that we're taking them from groups that were well represented in the respondents.
And this isn't the only source we'll be using.
Oh, I'm recommendation
to it. Yeah, and actually, we just thought it was good to tie around the convention. I mean, you know, in that we had an opportunity, we had stakeholders who were obviously interested in transportation. And if we allow this, we'll tie into what you'll hear over the next couple of days. In fact, the last session is one where we really are looking at the millennials. We have a presentation by John Martin, and then seven millennials, students that have got some innovative ideas. Just you have the baby boomers, us, most of us, and then the millennials. We're really going to shape transportation, our decisions here, that group. So
and he will be cautious in how we apply these results, but another way of looking at it is that we had almost 3,000 people participate in a survey that very much said we're interested in knowing how you feel about transportation in the Commonwealth and kind of drew them into the V-Trans process, so we're excited about that aspect.
I just had a comment. I was fortunate enough to be on a panel with Ms. Mitchell, probably within the last month, but one of the national trends that was presented at the time was that a little more than half, more than 50% of millennials actually in choosing where they want to live and work consider public transportation as one of the key factors in making a decision, which, you know, certainly ties in, even though the sampling's not huge, certainly
that's
a trend
I'm going to. And to point out, it doesn't necessarily mean urban areas. It means, it's like, for instance, here around, I mean, they want to have bikes, other transportation, whether in an urban or a rural setting.
Exactly. So it wasn't just in the major metropolitan areas, but having that access
was important.
Less
urban
areas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's
going
on.
Yes, Mr. Krasinski. Just more for Nick. Nick, as we move forward on V-Trans, and I know one of the priorities is corridors of statewide significance, but below that, are we going to be able to synthesize into our findings into the different regions? I think, you know, that's a synergy that I'd like, or synthesis I'd like to follow through on.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Krasinski, that's exactly what the needs assessment is going to be doing, and so just to foreshadow a little discussion in January, we're really going to do some analysis, one, on the corridor level for those 13 corridors of statewide significance, and then for each of the metro areas, and again, metro is 50,000 and up, so not Northern Virginia and, you know, Hampton Roads only. We're going to do a look at the economic conditions in there and then do some additional analysis based on that to be regionally specific, and then we'll be doing more localized analysis regarding the locally designated growth areas. So the needs assessment is going to be not just this high-level type of broad brush, but there's going to be some specific drill-down analysis in different types of areas and traffic markets.
Thank you.
And as you all know, this is all leading up to helping us determine the weightings and the scoring palettes or forms that we'll use across the Commonwealth.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I was talking about. I really wasn't talking about the number of participants, as
yeah.
much as I was, but it's not really a good representative group of what we got out here in Virginia. I don't think we can extrapolate too much of this into sitting there and setting those weightings. It's interesting.
I'll end out by saying that we're not going to get exact information. I think you're going to, so we'll have, but so our own judgments, our own experiences will go weighted into those. But yes, I agree with you in that regard. So, okay. Nick, did you have, Mr. Donahue, you have anything else you wanted before we wrap this session up? Okay. I think that concludes then our, unless there are any more questions from the board, that concludes our workshop session. I don't believe there's anything else to come before we go into the formal session. Are you guys comfortable? We're going to move into it. We've got about 45, 50 minutes to wrap up. You want to break or just go right into it? Okay, well, we'll just move on then, because I don't think, all right, so let's then, we'll close our session for the workshop, and we will now call to order the formal action session of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Our first order of business is any public comment. Ms. Mathis informed me there's none signed up, but is there anyone in the audience you would like to address the board before we begin? Mr. Pollard?
Good morning, Kurt Pollard with the Southern Environmental Law Center. I had three big topics in 3 minutes, so I'll be quick. First is, I just want to pick up on the last discussion you all just had. I think it's really important. I think that this survey has its pros and cons, but there's a lot of surveys nationwide, a lot of surveys throughout the region, by, you know, development analysts in particular, about the importance of providing a more balanced transportation program. I think that is a key to our economic future, as well as to achieving many of the other goals that we have set for our transportation program. And I'm a little disappointed and want to encourage you all as you go forward that the 6-year plan do a bit more to move us towards that more balanced transportation program. The second thing I just want to mention real quickly is a comment Mr. Connors mentioned, and Nick said this is something more for January and beyond, but importance of looking at not only the adaptation of our transportation system to climate change, but how our transportation decisions affect climate change. And hopefully that will be something that is prominent within both VTrans and HB2 prioritization. You all obviously have a lot of big decisions coming up about where do we place our priorities and our focus, and I would encourage you to keep that in mind. The main thing though I wanted to mention about was the third topic of the PPTA guidelines that I see are on the action agenda for today for you all to adopt. We strongly support the goals that you all set and the administration set in asking to revamp these guidelines, including increasing public awareness and involvement, increasing some oversight, increasing transparency. Unfortunately, the deadline for comments just closed 2 weeks ago, and then we have these before you. I have not had a chance to look at what will be before you, but it seems like that's a fairly short turnaround in terms of processing public input. We submitted extensive comments on October 31st and a number of particular changes. I do think that this manual represents a significant, these guidelines represent a significant improvement, and I just want to that as the highlight point. I think there's been a lot of great work by the office, I think we're going in the right direction. But I do think that there's some significant changes that are still needed, especially in the areas of increased transparency and public information. How this intersects with prioritization. There's only like two sentences in this manual on the biggest thing coming out of the most recent General Assembly. Obviously, because prioritization is a work in progress, this may be something that changes over time. So I want to flag some of these as much for what you all are asked about today as for what you might do next. The other two areas that I would like to mention, I think, are, I don't believe, are in the current version for you, they weren't in the version 2 weeks ago, is the prohibition of non-compete clauses, which has caused significant issues and problems, with, for example, with the deal that was struck over the Midtown and Downtown Tunnel. And then finally, completion of NEPA before moving to a procurement stage. I think we've got to be sure that we've got our environmental review process and our PPA process working in tandem. So those are some recommendations that we made on the last draft 2 weeks ago. I do not know to the extent they were addressed. My guess is not much in the last 2 weeks. But again, I think that the manual is a real, and guidelines are a real step in the right direction. I applaud the administration, this board for asking for that. But I do think there's some areas that need some continued work, and hopefully this won't be the final amendment to these guidelines that you all will make during your term. So just want to tee up some of those areas that I think we still really need to do some work on, and we'd be happy to discuss these issues further with staff. And again, the overall kudos for moving in the right direction. Thank you.
Any other public comments come before the board this morning? Okay, hearing none, we'll move on to the action item. First is the approval of the minutes from October 15, 2014. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any discussion or amendments? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Mr. Brule.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I have four action items for you today. The first is action on the FY15 primary extension improvement program allocation. I briefed the board on this new program last month. We've got, we're recommending funding going to the two highest scoring projects that you've received applications for. Those are going to be Chesapeake and the City of Canada. We recommend your approval.
Is there a motion?
Okay.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay. Item two, very similar to the first item, is action on the FY15 high volume unpaved road program allocations. We received two applications that had a tied score. We're recommending the available funding be split between those two projects.
Both of them would be eligible to receive FY16 funding as well, which would enable these projects to meet their advertisement date, and we recommend to approve it.
Do we have a motion?
I move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Oh, it's right. Okay. Second. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Item number three is action on an economic development access deallocation in the Stanton District, Page County. Page County had requested its economic development access funds in the past for a project that hasn't come to fruition, and the county has requested that we deallocate the funds and return them to the economic development access program for allocation to another project.
Commissioner Whitworth? Yes. Is there a second?
Second.
Right. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you.
Item number four is action on authorization for the commissioner to enter into standard project administration agreements between VDOT and the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority. This is a pretty standard order of business for us with local governments. The code provides that authority to the commissioner to enter into those types of agreements. But for agreements with authorities, that responsibility is vested in the board. With the funding that's coming to the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority, we've worked with them over the past several months to come up with an agreement template that would enable the department to administer projects on their behalf, reducing all of the costs with money that's coming from the NVTA. It's very similar to what we did a couple months ago here in Roanoke for the Federal Lands Access Program to give the commissioner the authority to enter into those agreements as those projects come up funded by the NVTA.
Commissioner Skarczynski, is there a second?
Second,
I'm sorry. Any discussion? Questions? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you. Mr. Hill, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I have one item. It's a commemorative bridge naming for Route 17, the Dominion Boulevard, in the city of Chesapeake. Requested to name it the Veterans Bridge. We do have a resolution from the City Council approving forwarding it to us for consideration, and we've assured that it's met our processes and procedures, and the department recommends its approval.
Mr. Morgan. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
School May. Good morning. Good morning, alumni, Mr. Coolman.
Always glad to be here, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and the members of the board. You have in your CTV decision brief in your book a review of the process that we undertook this year to refine and revise the PPTA guidelines, and then what I'm passing out is actually the November 2014 version. It incorporates the changes that have been made since we briefed the board last month. Those are detailed at the bottom of your decision brief, including the makeup of the PPTA steering committee, the addition of a mandatory notifications and briefings of the General Assembly, the addition of language to explain the purpose and use of a finding of public interest, which simply means that a public-private partnership would be certified as the most value, giving the most value in a procurement of a project and so forth. The additional changes that we've made that are incorporated in the November 2014 document are basically technical. Some are spelling errors, some are tense, some are changing and to a. Some are making sure that the document is internally consistent. The references to the appendices, for example, actually refer to the proper appendix and so forth. But they're only technical changes, and beyond the substantive additions that are in the decision brief, the document's otherwise largely the same. So we look forward to your decision today about the document. I think you can see from the resolution that you're both accepting the recommendations of the P3 office for the guidelines, and you're also recommending them to the Department of Transportation and the Department of Rail and Public Transportation that they adopt these guidelines and use them going forward. As I remarked a month ago,
We expect the I-66 multimodal project to be the first one to go forward under these guidelines. And if I might just simply respond, I think Mr. Pollard raised an interesting question. Our goal is to actually have these procurements be fully competitive, so there'd be no need for a non-competition clause. And we'll be sharing, obviously, the results this November 2014 document on our website today and going forward. I'd welcome any questions.
Any questions, or is there a motion?
Move.
Mr. Chairman, just want to, everyone's done a great job on this. I know this was a big topic of discussion early on, particularly this past spring when I got on the board, and just want to thank and compliment my colleagues, Mr. Kralin and Mr. Williams, for their work on this. I know Mr. Williams has told me he did an outstanding job on this work. But the thank you is serious, and I know this is a big deal to make sure that this finds a balance between enabling businesses who want to participate in these projects while also protecting the state. I think this is a good balance, and thank you.
Thank Mr. Kuhlman and his staff working, a lot of work was done. And I would point out that this is an iteration. I assume that as we go through, we may have more as we refine this process. But I think this strikes a good balance because, quite frankly, I believe if we follow this with some other things that we will not find ourselves in the position we have been in the Route 460 issue. So really appreciate everyone's efforts on that. I do believe it is the right thing to do. Any other discussion?
Mr. Cummings, thank you so much for your work and the work of your entire office as well as my colleagues. I just wanted, there was a lot of discussion when we were going through the early presentation about having the two or three oversight opportunities of the CTV board, particularly the third one, because it could affect predictability of a project. And within figure one and within the decision-making process, you have maintained three opportunities for us. And so I just wanted to recognize that and thank you for kind of listening to all the concerns from the board.
Well, thank you. Your views were very important, as were the ones from industry. Definitely, we want this to be a pragmatic document that creates the accountability and the competition we want on our side, but also reassures the private sector when they do get engaged in the procurement that we're committed to carry through as long as we're delivering a project substantially on scope with the financial arrangements that you all have approved. So, thank you.
Any other discussion? Comments? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Doug. Great thank job. You. Yeah. Let's see, Mr. Lawson's up.
Yes, good afternoon. Good morning. I have three items for you. First being the adoption action on the revised secure financial plan and the CTV and VDOT budget, and include the USMC budget as well.
We'll take them as one at a time. First one is on the revised fiscal 2015 budget for the Commonwealth Transportation Fund, Department of Rail and Public Transit. Is there a motion?
Motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Second.
Any opposed? Okay. Awesome.
Second item is the adoption of the revised safety improvement program as presented to you this morning.
Is there a motion?
Second.
Any discussion or comments? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay.
And well, last item I have for you this morning are the monthly transfers. You have in the package the list of projects that have that are over 10% that we have for you for your action. And you'll see from the 10 projects listed, they're all very small amounts and largely are transferring amounts from completed or canceled projects to other projects that are funding deficits.
Fair motion. Second?
Second.
Any other comments or discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Mr. Lawson, thank you very much.
Commissioners, Ms. Snyder.
There she is.
Good morning.
Good morning, Board members. I'm Lori Snyder with the Vitamin Utilities Division, and I have two items on the agenda for your approval today. The first is a limited access control change along Interstate 264 at the on-ramp at East City Hall Avenue in the city of Norfolk. This limited access control change would allow for the conveyance of roughly 5,600 square foot surplus property, which would accommodate the construction of an approved proposed one-way access road around the northeast corner of the Norfolk Consolidated Courts Complex. The department has reviewed this and we recommend your approval.
Thank you, Robert. Is there a second?
Second.
Any other discussion? Comments? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
The second item I have is in York County, and it is a request for a break in the limited access control along Route 171 and Victory Boulevard. This break is approximately 1,000 feet east of the intersection of Route 171 and Route 134. It measures approximately 40 feet in length and wide along the north proposed right-of-way limited access line along Route 171. By allowing this break, it would also close the existing right-in and right-out only movement that is currently along Route 134.
Motion for
second.
Even though I don't vote, I'm going to have a conflict here, so I'm not voting, just about acknowledging I have a conflict. All those in favor, please say.
I'm going to abstain on this vote.
Mr. Chairman, I also am going to abstain on this vote.
Okay, so all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you. Motion passes, yes. Mr. Sebastian, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I have one item to bring forward today for limited access change in Hanover County, which is located in our Richmond district. Involved the I-295-360 interchange and the movement of the existing Bell Creek intersection. Hanover County, by letter dated October 27, 2014, supports limited access change. FHWA has also approved the limited access change. The department recommends approval. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Is there a motion?
Second.
All any discussion? Yes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thanks very much.
I think that concludes our action item. Is there any new business to come before the board today?
Oh, Mr. Kilpatrick.
Just very briefly, each of you have a copy of our business plan that we recently completed. Business plan, it lays out, I would say, some overarching goals and some specific areas we're going to work on, just highlighting some things more generally. Preservation of our infrastructure, picking the right projects, that's House Bill 2, but that's really also how we fund our maintenance program in terms of pavements and bridges and so on. Public outreach, connection with our customers, and also in the area of, and you heard some of this today, about better linking the highway system and other modes and integrating those in our program. So again, this is our playbook going forward. And in the action items, again, you'll see things that these are some focus areas over the next year, but very fundamentally, it's on making sure that our assets are maintained in good order. So if you have any questions after you look at it, we'd be glad to answer them. But again, you have that at your desk.
Okay, Ms. Mathis, you have some administrative instruction for us.
Yes. Once our meeting ends, all of you have that name tag and bars and registered for the conference. Your name tag is your key to all the events. You have a little bit of time to go and put your bag in your room. You're welcome to pass to the buffet lunch at 12 o'clock in Roanoke Hall. And at 12:40, we need you all to meet back here so we can walk in the group over to the ground break.
12:40, yeah. We're in this room to be here. So we all go over, we'll then have the groundbreaking, and then we will go from there into the conference, and the conference will start with the governor's address after the groundbreaking. Okay, where is the buffet, by the way?
Donut Bar.
That starts about noon, so we have, by noon, so we have about an hour, and about an hour and 20 minutes to be back in here. Okay, we're adjourned. Thank you.